Welcome to Partnering Leadership, conversations with leading influencers in the greater Washington, D.C. region and global thought leaders, helping you align better with your purpose, grow professionally with meaning, and have a greater impact. For additional leadership insights and bonus content, visit us at partneringleadership.com. Now here's your host, Mahan Tavakoli.
Welcome to Partnering Leadership. I'm really excited as you're joining me on this journey of learning and growth. And I know you're enjoying these conversations based on your feedback, so please keep that coming. Mahan at MahanTavakoli.com. And also there is a microphone icon on PartneringLeadership.com website. Feel free to leave me voice messages there. For those on Apple, leave a rating and review. That will make it easier for more people to find these podcast episodes. Now this week, I am thrilled to be having a conversation with Ximena Hartsock. Ximena's journey has been magnificent as an immigrant to this country, starting as a nanny, bartender, teacher, moving on to serving in the administration of D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty, eventually helping start an organization, Phone to Action, that has been instrumental in advocacy, and at the end of 2020, leaving for new ventures as she is going to continue having an impact and making a difference both on our region, on the nation, and globally. Listen to her episode, be inspired, learn from her leadership journey. Now, here is my conversation with Ximena Hartsock. Ximena Hartsock, welcome to the Partnering Leadership Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited, Ximena, knowing a lot about your background and story, and can't wait to share some of that with the broader Partnering Leadership community. Now, you were born and raised in Santiago, Chile, and I know your father and his reading had a big impact on your childhood. So how did that childhood impact the kind of person you have become?
Thank you for the question. See, my father was indigenous. Mother and father were Mapuche. In Chile, the Mapuche tribe ethnicity is the primary one. And he was born in a sort of type of reservation in the south of Chile. And so he met my mother, and they have like a very interesting love story, because my mom had been in a boarding school and he wanted to be a nun. And both of them, they marry and they ran away to Santiago. In a way, it wasn't like 100% ran away. They wanted to also look for opportunities, but their marriage wasn't anything that the two families were looking for. So I think that the spirit of immigration came a little bit from them. My mother was very much dedicated to the four of us. We were three girls and one boy, and all very close in age. So that was a lot of work. And my father was the main worker in the house. He's the one that provided for all of us. But my father was a very good reader. While my parents were very humble, they had come to the city without anything, no connections, no money, nothing. My father's reading educated him and prepared him not only to do better over time in his job, but also to guide us through that time, because we were born and raised during the dictatorship, where the access to the globalization that we have today, to the news and to pop culture, wasn't accessible for us at the time. And so my father provided a lot of that context with the world, because he was a very good reader. And he bought at least two newspapers every Sunday, and he read the paper every day. And he would love to read the paper in a very organized way from cover to cover. And I will steal pieces of the paper. And that's my love for reading came from. A lot of those readings actually were about the United States, because my dad was a very avid history reader. He kept up with the news about the U.S. as well, too. He knew every president's bio of the U.S. He knew lots of portions of the Constitution of the United States, and he was a very big fan of the process of writing the Constitution. He loved all of the cowboy movies, and so we knew since very young age about John Wayne, and my mother loved Fred Astaire movies. So in a way, in a very accidental way, I would say, my childhood gave me context about the United States way before I would even think that I would come and live here.
That's a wonderful story. And it's interesting that your mother and father weren't rule followers to a certain extent, that their love story led them to each other. And I read that at age 11, you tried to save a classmate from getting expelled and even led to a protest in your school to let a nun have long hair.
Oh, yes. Actually, we had several advocacy activities in my school, and we were all around 11. And from there, we just kind of continue on. And they were all kind of one after the other. And so the nun story that we were in a Catholic all-girls school, but the school was connected to the home of the nuns. And it was this big tree that we would go and climb to. And that's how we learned that the nuns actually had long hair, because we thought all of them were bald because they would cover their hair. And it was this nun that we loved, and she was just so wonderful to us. And we saw her one day jumping on a swimming pool, moving her hair and waving it around. And we just, I guess, intuitively know of felt that she really loved to share and move her hair around. And it was just that without words, a connection, women to women, all of these girls on the tree watching, spying really on the nuns. That's what we would do on recess. And then seeing this nun waving her hair from left to right in the air, feeling so happy and free, that we thought that's what she wants to do all the time. So we went around the school and started putting signs and everything, asking the superior nuns to allow this poor nun to show her hair. And we probably got in trouble. I don't remember that part, but I'm pretty sure we did. And we did all kinds of other things. We had a war protest one day where we wrote on the signs, they had cut the water. Every year, the junior students, because our school was K-12, they will have the last party. It was a festival of water, basically. Basically, they will throw water at each other, and it was a little bit of a farewell to K-12 education, because the next year they will be seniors and they had to be worried about transition to college. And so this was like the very last say goodbye to being a K-12 student, and it became a very big tradition in Chile that you will throw these little bubbles of water to each other. It was just pure fun. But that year, they didn't allow them to do it. And so we were much younger. I said one day, we have to do something. We have to organize. We need to get them to do something. And we organized the entire school, basically, that anyone that could in the classrooms to come out from the back door while the teacher was teaching at the front. Some of us will sneak out, go to the lab and write posters, come back, sit in class. Other girls will go out, write more posters. And then during recess, we all broke out and did this major protest, completely simultaneous, completely coordinated with these posters that said, they deserve water, they have the right to water, give them anything, wine will work. And it was all very funny and cute. They were able to get their last opportunity to say goodbye to their education in the way that every other school in the country was able to do. And I think after that, they made it a policy that they couldn't do that. But at least that year, we were able to get them to do their way. And we did many other things to save kids from bullying or save kids from being mistreated by anybody. But I think it was just the fact that being all girls, I felt very free maybe, or protected by that community, that if we would speak up within ourselves, it was okay. I just never felt worried about it. And probably I should have, because my parents were. After all of this, I always got in trouble, but it didn't teach me to stop. So I think it was the beginning of something.
Yeah, absolutely. It's obvious that you started your activism very early on, and your parents were at least supportive enough to educate you and inform you to get involved in all these different activities.
Yes, they were. They were.
So, Ximena, what then brought you to the United States?
So I was raised in a country that didn't really have at the time a lot of culture of not only innovation, but also freedom to work more than the 9-to-5 job. So I felt that men and women, pretty much anyone I knew, they just had the job. And my father was a little bit of an outcast because he loved his job. And I wanted that. I wanted to have a job that I would feel very passionate about it. So I went to college and I studied philosophy and Spanish literature. And when I graduated, before I graduated, you do a lot of practicums. I did these practicums, several practicums to teaching in the classroom. which I like a lot. I love the kids and I love the education portion of it. But then I knew right away that I wasn't going to pay the bills. So I had to get another job. And that's where I realized the country was very much backwards, because I could not get a part-time job anywhere. It was impossible. In my last year of college, I was teaching for 6 months, because in Chile, your last year is almost just all internships. And I couldn't get another job. And I had been able to work as a bartender before, but not, you couldn't do that while you were working, because the country didn't have the structure for that. Like, it didn't seem also to be part of the culture that you can have a day job. And I felt that I had to do all of that if I wanted to make progress in my youth, and especially in the beginning of my career. So I felt really disillusioned by the workforce too. I didn't find very stimulating anyone that I was talking to, like even my friends. It was all very much status quo and very complacent. And so I started right away looking for opportunities to go abroad. And I started with Spain. I applied to the University of Salamanca, and I just couldn't put scholarships together. All this time in Spain is very expensive. And those memories of the US from all the movies that I have seen during the childhood came to mind. And I told my dad, how about I go to the US? Will you let me go to the US? He said, yes, you know, go. So I went to the embassy, lined up for hours, because they had only one person processing visas at the time, I remember. So I lined up. I was up for like 2-3 hours between all of the lines that you have to do, and I got a visa. I was very happy, because at the time, to get a visa, you had to prove a lot of things. And I came to the US, and that was that. But I came really looking for a place where I could unleash a lot of that desire to do more things. It wasn't specifically about just having more better jobs and make more money. It was also about doing more things. I felt a little bit trapped in the culture that I was in Chile. I didn't feel that people had a lot of drive, and probably I was not hanging out with the right people. I'm sure there are plenty of Chileans that do have that drive, but at the time I didn't see that. And that was the main reason why I came, because I aspired to be in the culture of the US that I saw, I perceived as one with drive and motivation to do more.
In that statement, Ximena, and in that part of your story, you capture the most beautiful part of one of the strengths of this country, where immigrants that want to contribute more, want to do more, want to be more, come to the US to pursue those ambitions and also contribute to the community. So that is absolutely beautiful. Now, how was your initial transition here in the US? How did that work out for you?
So I didn't have any friends or family or money. I came with $500, which I thought at the time it was so much money. And then I realized really quickly that it was really not a lot, especially because I spent a lot of those in donuts. I remember I had been raised Catholic, and so I knew about Georgetown University. I took a bus to Georgetown, and I remember walking into the campus, and you have the library on the left, and then you have all the pathways, and seeing all the students, and I remember crying. I cried of emotion that I was there, and I knew when I walked, and I wasn't a student, I just went in just to check it out like a tourist. But that was one of the very first destinations I had, and I remember thinking, wow, this was a great decision, because it felt so right to be here. When I walked through all of the numbers of young students walking in the campus, and I just felt really happy and emotional there. My transition, I think it was great, because I was so thankful to be here. When I look back, I didn't really have anything. I came in March, I think, or April. I remember the weather being not so great, and I was coming from the summer in Chile, so I wasn't very adjusted clothes-wise. I probably brought sunglasses. I'd never been in an environment with snow, so I did have to transition. I probably got a big bad cold in the beginning, but I did all of those jobs. I started looking for jobs where I could, you know, support myself. So I did all of those jobs that immigrants have sometimes when they come here. And in my case, I had to have, because I didn't have anything else. And so I worked as a nanny. I was a housekeeper. I was also a bartending. I remember I bought a Hispanic newspaper, and they had, you know, on the jobs portion, it was all in Spanish, so I could read it. They had some ads, but I couldn't really see necessarily what jobs were available. But I looked at the restaurant section. And in the restaurant section, I noticed that most of the restaurants were all in the same street. So I took a bus one day, and I went, this is in Columbia Pike in Arlington, Virginia, and I went from top to top of that street, knocking restaurant doors. And I got lucky because one of those restaurants, it was called Cecilia's at the time, they gave me a job and I worked there. I did all of those jobs. And then at the same time, I was taking English classes. I eventually did register in Georgetown for English first. And then I got my credentials for teaching certificates here in the US. So I became a teacher later on after coming here.
Yeah, fabulous. So the $500 evaporated in donuts. You found yourself working really hard to pursue education. And at the same time that you were working all these different jobs from nanny to the restaurants, you were obviously, you already had your education and you were pursuing more education. And then you eventually end up becoming a school principal.
Yes. So I, started a career in education from the very, very bottom. And I was the eighth of an eighth of the classroom teacher. And then I was the eighth of the teacher. And then I started teaching and doing also project coordination of a federal grant in mathematics. In that program is where I had the opportunity to work in several schools. And in one of those schools, Harriet Tubman Elementary School in Washington, D.C., this was actually an elementary and middle school. The principal was becoming the assistant superintendent of the region. And she had met me working in that program and she said, I would love to have you apply for the assistant principalship here. So I applied and I got the job. And then when I was doing that job as an assistant principal, I finished 1 year and they asked me to apply to be the principal of another school. So I became the principal of this other school. And during that work is where I met the mayor of the city, because at the time he was a city council member. And we had worked very, very hard in this school to increase the proficiency in mathematics and in reading that the school had been suffering for quite a bit. The school was also very divided. We were going through gentrification. It's a school that is in a historic area, but had traditionally been serving kids that were Hispanic or African American. And with the gentrification, the neighbors that the residents were different type of just background in general, and they were looking for a school that served their needs. And so I had to come in to work with the community to reconcile all the differences and build a school that would work for everybody and that would still be inclusive and still serve poor kids. And that's very difficult because it's very difficult to get everyone to agree that all are going to be okay living and coexisting with each other, especially if in the mix you have kids that are poor and often of color or kids that are from same gender parents. And we had all of that in our school. I will never say I here ever because it was definitely not an I. It was a we. Together, we improved the standardized testing by 20% for both reading and math. And the city council member at the time, Adrian Fenty, came to the school, and because we were all celebrating, we had a festival about it and the city was really excited about the progress of the school. And that's how I met him when he was a city council member. And eventually he became the mayor. And that's where the story changes a little bit.
Yeah. And obviously you had different positions and with more and more success, eventually the mayor wanted you to serve, appointed you to serve as district's Department of Parks and Recreation director. And it broke my heart as father of two girls to read the quotes of one of the individuals at that point. Marion Barry was serving on the council. He was no longer the mayor, that he opposed your nomination. And I quote said, "Women don't care about sports as much as men do."
Yes. So when the city council member Frente became the mayor, he wanted to improve the city in many areas. One of them was education. So he did an education reform, a very famous one with Michelle Rhee. I became assistant superintendent of schools under Michelle Rhee. When I was doing that job is when the mayor asked me to join the cabinet and become the director of Parks and Rec. And the vision that he had for the city is one where kids were safe and protected from 8 to 3 p.m. during the school day. And then they had a place to go to be safe and protected in the afternoon and during the weekends. And so his vision for the Department of Parks and Recreation was a lot more than the traditional, we have a rec center, you can come if you want, to we have a very rich set of offerings and solid constructions and new parks and better turf fields and everything, because we want the kids to want to be there. And so that's why he asked me, and he selected someone with a career in education. By then, I have been principal assistant superintendent of schools. I have been part of major initiatives. And so he wanted to bring some of the same set of skills to the Department of Parks and Rec. He was trying something a little bit new. And, you know, I did that job with so much passion, and I brought in some of the best and brightest in the city that many of them followed me from schools to try to improve the services that at the time were very much just very, very bad. And the city council at the time, Marion Barry was alive and he was part of it, and he didn't agree with some of the politics of the mayor had, and in a way he decided with other that they will use the opportunity to not confirm it in a way to show the mayor that they had power and that they could do that. And so it's very interesting that this happened in the same decade where we have the Me Too movement, where we have so much outrage against women mistreatment, that a city council member not only will say that as a woman, I didn't have any knowledge of sports, because he said the quote that he said, but he also said Hispanic women were not prepared to do a job like that. It's unfortunate. It's a good thing that he has not witnessed the revolution now, because he probably will be embarrassed for his words. But that was quite accepted and acceptable at the time, because others within the same city council didn't raise an eyebrow about it, and you didn't see any protests or anybody saying anything. And in fact, after that, I had to, in a way, reinvent my career, because doesn't look good when you are not confirmed by a city council. And I had to do it by myself and on my own. It was a very difficult process that left a lot of people in pain, the people on my team and everything. But it happened without really any consequences for them or anyone that were actors for the matter.
It's obviously a hard thing to go through, and I'm glad that you referenced the timing of it. This is not early 1900s we're talking about. Obviously, you're a young woman yourself. This is pretty recent in terms of the way you were treated in this. But I imagine both your activism from your childhood, your father reading to you and you being active in his school, and experiences like this led to your desire to get people together to have a voice in their government, leading to starting Phone to Action.
It's interesting, the question that you asked me about what happened with the situation with the city council, because every time people ask me about Phone to Action, I always talk about Phone to Action being the product of my last job, where I was an education advocacy organizer, and I would travel from state to state organizing parents and teachers to talk to their lawmakers about education reform. And so I did that after I left the government. But now that you mentioned, you asked me this question after the other question, I think I remember during that time feeling pretty powerless. I remember feeling voiceless, and I remember not knowing how to defend myself or talk about it. It was so new to me. And now that I look back, when the mayor asked me to take that on, that position, I should have known that that was a little bit of a political move, but I didn't at the time. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that we don't really talk about all of the implications sometimes of the moves that we make in our careers, because for women, many times that journey is very lonely. And so that, for men and for women, I think change is difficult for men and for women today. There is a little bit of disillusion with establishment in general, whether you're a Republican or you're a Democrat. I think that is a sense of what, as the way I wanted, that there is a little bit of nostalgia of the past, and that there is definitely a lack of connection with lawmakers. And Phone to Action as a technology for a digital grassroots build that connection. But I think it's also the creation of that tool is probably in my unconscious thinking, I probably was a little bit influenced by all of these experiences together to create Phone to Action.
you're marrying the activism that, again, has been running throughout your life with some of your own experiences to bring power to the people. So you start, co-found Phone to Action. It's been growing really fast, doing really well. Where do you see the trajectory and the impact of this business that you have started?
When I had the idea of Phone to Action was late 2011, 2012, the adoption of smartphones was much, much lower than is now, especially for minorities. And at the time, I remember I was moving from town to town and talking to people, and they would say, I don't know who my lawmakers are and I don't know how to contact them. So Phone to Action started as a response to the question that I had is, how can we not have any technology that makes it easy for people to connect with their lawmakers easily from whatever device that they have on their hands or on their desktop. So granted, it's going to work on a desktop. It's going to be a set of technology that is accessible on a computer, but it should also be accessible on a phone or an iPad or any device that exists. And so that has been the mantra of Phone to Action since the inception. And our first platform was launched in 2013. And since then, and it has become one, if not the pioneer leader and leader technology solution for grassroots advocacy. And for the listeners that never heard of Phone to Action, you have seen Phone to Action in action. Perhaps even you have taken action on it in many of the campaigns that are out there to mobilize people on an issue. For example, this year after COVID, National Nurses Association, National Restaurants Association, Farmers Association have used Phone to Action to advocate on issues. Expedia, Ben & Jerry's, Hallmark are also companies that use Phone to Action for advocacy and now also for elections. So if you are a fan of Billie Eilish or Ariana Grande or Taylor Swift, you probably have used Phone to Action to identify whether you're registered to vote or to find your polling locations or to register to vote. So Phone to Action, this is a long answer to your question, but Phone to Action really has to stay very close to the vision that it had from the very beginning. But now it's definitely a more mature company. We had several rounds of venture capital. We got a growth funding round last year from a private equity firm, and we started a process of acquisitions and the growth that you see today with the company. We are in the U.S., in all the states of the U.S. We're in Canada, in Australia, and in Europe. And the vision of democratizing policy making and giving people tools to hold their lawmakers and to talk to them in the manner that they prefer at any time. That vision continues strong to be, but the technology is even more empowering than ever was.
It's a powerful tool and a powerful story and a powerful system for giving power to the people that are responsible for making change happen in the society. And you're doing a fabulous job with that. So now, Ximena, you've had a pretty unique experience when you were growing up and then as an immigrant to the States, now as a successful founder of an organization that is having an impact. If you were to give advice to your younger self with respect to how to approach the future to become as successful as you've become, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I never made a plan. I think life took me with life. And I never said, I want to do this, this, this. And I think because of that, my instincts were always very ready to go. And they got sharper over time because I continue to make decisions based on those things. And while I made mistakes like the one I referred earlier, being a little bit naive when I took up a political job, not knowing it was a political job, I did make mistakes like that. I think that I'd rather have gone that way and follow my instincts than not, because then today I wouldn't have the intuition and the guts that I have that makes everything so much easier. So the advice that I would give to me as a younger self, it probably would be to look a little bit for more fun in the picture. I think I have had my set of fun, but I did work a tremendous amount of hours, 14 to 16 hours a day for years is sometimes unsustainable. And today day, I realized that I could have done it with less. And I could have spent a little bit more time in other things and maybe spending more time with my father before he passed away. I remember when he passed, I was so close to him and it was crushing for me that I didn't stay with him his last month of life. And I didn't because my work ethics were a little bit to the extreme and I came back to the US after seeing him sick in January and then my dad passed away in February. And I wish I would have stayed with him and spent all of those weeks with him. It would have been nothing. It would have made no harm to anyone. It didn't really, me being here for those 3-4 weeks didn't make a difference in my job in a dramatic way. And I could have done that and I didn't. So I think the advice it is, family is always first. It has to be always be first. And job is going to be there tomorrow. And being smart about the hours. I don't talk about balance because I don't think that's a good word for it, because I think everyone's schedule is different and people have to make the best of it. And everything in my life, in my opinion, is all blurry, all the lines blur. But I do think that you do want to think about regrets and try not to have regrets. And I do have that regret about my father, and I hope not to have it again with anyone I love.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ximena, now I know your child is a little too young for you to have seen Coco, but the movie is about the Mexican Day of the Dead. And one of the most magnificent parts of it is that as long as people are remembered, they stay in this other universe. They are totally lost when they are forgotten. And one of the most beautiful things in your story is that the impact that your father, his reading, his sharing insights with you from early on had on you, retelling that story to a certain extent keeps him and his memory alive, which is wonderful to see and hear because he is represented therefore in you and through you. Now, one final thought. I was wondering if there are any leadership resources that you find yourself recommending to others and say, this might be a good thing for you to think about as you look to improve your own leadership and leading your organizations.
So leadership to me is an act of love in a big way. And I think the more you give to other people, and I'm not trying to be a self-promoter here or cheesy, generally, I think the more giving we do, the better leaders we become and our sphere of influence becomes wider. And so memberships to any communities where there are voluntary opportunities, those are very important. I'm a member of the Washington Economic Club where I try to participate in the scholars effort. It has several efforts for entrepreneurs and for people in need, especially people of color. And I am very close to a lot of people. So a lot of those, my friends that were waitresses and house cleaners 20 years ago, they're still my friends. And so that is an opportunity for me also to help. And that's a lot that I learned from them as well. In terms of resources, there are 3 books that I can think of. The first one is actually a book in education. It's called Schools That Learn. And it was written by Peter Senge, which is the MIT professor that wrote The 5th Discipline. And this book is not a book about education. This is a book about leadership because it talks about the 5 principles of leadership, mental models, personal mastery, etc. But it's a very good progression on how to achieve all of those. And personal mastery, why personal mastery is important for leadership? Because through personal mastery, you learn about yourself. So you can't help others if you don't know your own weaknesses. So you can check yourself when you are making a mistake. You can check yourself. And that is so extremely important. And mental models, so you know the assumptions that we make about people, learning how to fight those are important. So we have an open eye because we're people of color. I'm a person of color, but that doesn't mean that I'm not going to have bias. I can have bias too against others. So it's as important to check ourselves. And then the other book that I really like is Ninja Innovation. It was written by Gary Shapiro. And this book is all about technology and consumer electronics innovation and also the journey of it. And it's very interesting. It was a good crash for me into technology. And I appreciate everything that Gary has there because he has a lot of vignettes about times where Bill Gates and Zuckerberg were in the same room. And it's just very interesting. The last one is this one. You probably seen it, Mahan, is the How to Lead book. I'm actually just reading this book. And it was written by David Rubenstein. It just came out a couple of months ago. It's about the wisdom from the world's greatest biggest CEOs. You have here people like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, but also RGB is in it. And I'm really looking forward to read the way that they exercised and learned to become better leaders.
Fabulous. What great recommendations of resources. And more importantly, what a magnificent life story where you have pursued your aspirations, have been impactful, have worked at all levels within the society, moved yourself up, educated yourself, started an impactful organization. So I'm sure you're going to accomplish many more great things. And I look forward in the future catching up again with you, Ximena. But thank you so much for sharing your story, your passion, and your vision with the audience of the Partnering Leadership Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks everyone for listening.
You've been listening to Partnering Leadership with your host, Mahan Tavakoli. For additional leadership insights and bonus content, visit us at partneringleadership.com.